Live from Utrecht. This is Bitcoin
Explained.
Hey, Sjors.
Hello.
How have you been?
Not bad. It's only been 3 months.
No. Was our last episode also a Bitcoin Core release episode, perhaps?
No. We talked about silent payments.
Oh, that's right. Yes, that is right. Well, this time we're going to discuss the new Bitcoin Core release, because there is one.
Version 28.0.
First, here's a message from our sponsor, CoinKite. Sure, she put a bunch of presents here for me to look at.
That's right.
This looks like a battery.
Yeah, this is a 9-volt battery. You know, this square-shaped battery for people who don't know what they look like.
A Duracell battery.
And then there's a little device next to it that is, I believe, called Power, which you can connect to the 9-volt battery, and then it can power any USB device. But, you know, probably the USB device you want to power with it is the gold card.
So this is a CoinKite product that I'm holding right now?
Yes.
And, oh, I see. Yes. It's very unfortunate in moments like these that we don't have any video with our podcast.
Well, there's
okay, so I'm now attaching this little, like, USB device.
You should do it closer to the mic, and then we can play the game that they do in Q Music called Het Geluid, the sound, and then you have to guess what sound it is.
This is a very Dutch in-joke. Okay, so now I connected the battery to the thingy, and now what? Now it's charging?
No, now that's just a USB port. Now you can connect the USB cable to that, and then the cold card to it, and then you have your hardware wallet getting power, not so much charging, because I don't think it has a battery,
mm-hmm.
But just it has power, so you can turn it on, and you can move your files from the hardware wallet to the computer without having this device connected to a USB port of the computer.
I have absolutely no idea what's going on here, but I also don't want to linger on it for 10 minutes.
That's right.
They're not paying us enough for that. It's a very cool device, though. It's called the
Cold Power. But I think they primarily want to sell more cold cards, their hardware wallets.
Okay, cold cards. Wait, but I got something else as well. Here is the tap signer. Oh, what is this, Shores?
You can tap it and then it signs things. I think it's just kind of like an extra key.
It just has your private key on it?
Yeah, that wouldn't be your like savings private key, obviously. It could be just one of many keys.
And this is another CoinKite product. CoinKite's making all sorts of stuff nowadays, Shores. I remember when they were just making hardware wallets.
The open times.
Yeah. I mean, they've been at it for a long time, actually. Like, Rodolfo was at the 2014 conference in Amsterdam.
Oh, that's 10 years ago.
Yeah, I don't remember what he was like. He was already, like, selling stuff and building thingies and, you know, gadgets and who knows what. I don't think it was hardware. Maybe it was, actually, back then. I don't know. And then here we got the calculator-looking hardware wallet as well.
The Q.
Okay, this is way more than they paid for. Let's get to the actual episode here, Sjors.
Well, there's another fun news, which is that, how do I say this? Aaron Stacks sets. Because we have connected you in Fountain, so that the sets that are streamed now also go to you. So you didn't have to set up your own node.
I think we need to make more episodes for that to actually return some dividend. I haven't seen anything come in, I think.
No, because we haven't done an episode
since. Yeah, okay, there we go.
And they're not a sponsor.
Apparently people aren't paying us for doing nothing.
The podcasting 2.0 stuff.
So let's get to the actual episode here, Shorts.
Yes, sir.
Bitcoin Core 28. We've mentioned in basically every other Bitcoin Core, you know, new release episode that there is a new Bitcoin Core release every half year. People know that by now, which means that whatever is done at a certain time goes in. If it's not done yet, then it doesn't go in. You know, this is kind of different with some other software products. You will release a new version when some sort of new feature is done. Bitcoin Core, nope. Every half year, there's just whatever is done is in there. So we're going to discuss what's in there. This time there are some at least slightly interesting things in there.
Yes.
I would say.
I'd say it's quite a lot of interesting things.
Yeah, it's like an actual upgrade. Sometimes it's, you know, it seems sort of like a maintenance upgrade. Now there's some actual new stuff here. We'll start off with what is, at least in my personal opinion, the least interesting one I don't know why we're even discussing this.
I think it's one of my favorites.
The Testnet one?
Testnet 4. Oh, that's God. Right, ladies
why
and gentlemen.
Why are we talking about Testnet? Short? Testnet is not Bitcoin. Anyway, so there's a new Testnet. Shorts wants to talk about the new Testnet. What's new with the new Testnet?
Well, there's two things in there. One is there were recently block storms, also known as the Lopocalypse. Lopocalypse. It's hard to pronounce, actually. It's easier to write.
The that is harder to pronounce than you would think.
Jameson Lopp was just trolling everyone with just a single laptop, producing hundreds of thousands of blocks, making Testnet 3 unusable for people with bad software, but also generally not easy to use. And it was exploiting a bunch of well-known vulnerabilities in Testnet 3 specifically. The problem with Testnet fundamentally, and we'll never be able to fix that, is that it cannot fully rely on proof of work the way Bitcoin does. Because all the proof of work is on Bitcoin, and if it was the same as Bitcoin, it would be a shitcoin, and it would be attacked.
The problem, of course, is that performing proof of work actually costs, requires you to perform proof of work. There's like actual energy you have to expend.
Yeah.
And the reason miners do that on Bitcoin is because they get paid for it in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
While Testnet, which is designed to not be worth anything. And if it does get worth, if people start valuing it, they reset it, and, they being the developer. So it's like designed to not have any value. So therefore, there's actually no incentive to perform proof of work there.
Yeah. And even if there was, which indeed, the sort of the rule is that if that happens, if people start valuing Testnet coins, then it gets reset. There's just a new Testnet, which is what's happening. And part of the reason is because people started selling Testnet 3 coins. But it was also just becoming harder and harder to use. And one of the weaknesses in the Testnet 3... So in order to deal with this lack of incentives, it has a few extra... Testnet has a few extra rules that keep it somewhat workable in the face of miners messing with the network. In particular, what could happen without these rules is a miner decides to put like a giant ASIC farm on Testnet 3... increase the difficulty to some really, really high difficulty and then disappear. And then if you're just at home trying to test something with your CPU, you just cannot mine a block anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so Testnet had a rule that after 20 minutes, you could do it anyway at a very low difficulty. And it was a bunch of these rules, and they were such that they were creating a mess because it was too easy to mine hundreds of thousands of blocks very quickly. And Testnet 4 fixes that. At least fixes it somewhat, because fundamentally you can't really fix it.
Yeah, okay. So how does Testnet 4 fix it?
I don't know. I forgot. It basically adds a few more constraints to the timestamp. I think one of the problems was that you would... So after 20 minutes, you were able to mine a block at difficulty 1, which is the lowest difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you would do is the last block in the difficulty period would also be 1, and then you would keep doing that, then the difficulty would permanently be 1.
Mm.
So it wouldn't be temporary for 20 minutes, it would just be permanent. And so I think the new rule is that the block at the edge of the difficulty period has to be the normal difficulty. So the downside is that if some ASIC drives up the difficulty, you can mine blocks after 20 minutes, but not the first block of the difficulty period. So some ASIC will have to come around once every 2 weeks to produce one block,
mm-mm,
if this happens, but they can't then lower the difficulty permanently.
Okay.
Because the problem is, once the difficulty
is gone... I hope you can excuse me for kind of not being very interested in all the adversarial ways that Testnet can be abused.
No,
I want to just move on to actual Bitcoin here.
Yeah. This is fundamental.
I mean, if you think there's something to add for our listener that might find this interesting, go ahead. But I'm done with the Testnet stuff, sure.
Well, then you want to talk about the time warp fix?
Yes, let's go to the... Oh, no, that is still Testnet.
Yeah. But I thought
we were already there. Go for it.
Well, the time warp fix is something we talked about in the Great Consensus Cleanup episode.
Yes.
So it's useful to try that on Testnet, simply because, maybe one day we want to use it on mainnet, but that's not the immediate plan here. And one practical reason why it's being deployed on Testnet is because the time warp attack is another way to very quickly mine all the coins, like mine the whole subsidy. So you want to prevent that. We definitely want to prevent that on mainnet. because that's just bad. But on testnet, it's also important to prevent it, because otherwise someone's going to mine all 21 million coins on testnet, and then we have to make another testnet.
Which is totally fine.
For you, yeah, but it's a pain in the butt to make a new testnet. There's actual work involved.
Okay. So there is a time warp fix that is part of the Great Consensus Cleanup, which we discussed just 2 episodes ago.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone, you know, still has that fresh in their memory.
Exactly.
From, you know, January 2022 or whenever the last episode was.
2 weeks ago.
But that has been rolled out on testnet. So in a way, it's also being tested now, I guess. You can sort of see it that way.
Yeah, and it already led to some discussion. Some people argued that this fix is not good enough, not even for mainnet. And so it's good to have this code out there. When code is actually out there, people are more likely to look at it and critique it.
Good.
But one thing that's important to point out, I already kind of said it, but oftentimes when there's a software proposal, people hash out the whole software proposal, then they agree, then they deploy it on testnet, then they deploy it on mainnet. That's not what's happening here. This is just a test on testnet. It's not like the test that's, you know, we're about to do this on mainnet.
Yeah, this is actually, so there's actually a practical reason to use this on testnet right now. That's the reason it's on testnet right now,
not to test it
for mainnet.
Well, it's there to test in case we want it for mainnet, but it's not like the typical software test on testnet is really like, okay, we think this is completely ready. Whereas in this case, we don't think that.
Right. Okay. Done with testnet?
Yes.
Awesome. Let's go to Bitcoin.
Talk about the mempool.
Yeah, so there's an actual...
Well, the mempool isn't really the blockchain either, so do you care? Or are you going to fall asleep again?
Mempool definitely counts. Mempool counts as Bitcoin.
Okay.
Mempool is sort of...
You heard it here first.
Yeah, I count it. I count it, George. I care about the mempool for reasons that we're going to explain right now. So there has been sort of a package of upgrades, which also includes a package. It's true, though. So the problem in a nutshell, and the reason that this is needed, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, is in case there are any listeners that don't know this, you know, every Bitcoin node has a mempool, and the mempool collects transactions that are then included in blocks. So there's sort of like a waiting room for transactions until they're actually included in the blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are a miner, then you're actually mining from the mempool of your node, essentially.
Yeah. There's no one mempool. Everybody has their own mempool, but all the mempools tend to be very similar, especially the top of the mempool, the thing that's probably going to be mined next.
Right. But there is a problem, namely that mempools are also limited in size. Like, it depends per person or per node how big that size is exactly. But ultimately, a mempool also is a size, you know, in the same way that a Bitcoin block is a size, a maximum size. So if your transaction doesn't have enough V, then it will actually drop out of people's mempools.
Yeah.
Now, this is a real problem, especially for second layer protocols like Lightning,
mm-hmm.
where sometimes you need to get a transaction that is sort of pre-made, pre-signed. You need to get it into a block, but first of all, you need to get it into a mempool to get it into a block. Now, if the fee is too low to get it into a block, but it at least gets into the mempool, you can fix that with this trick called child pays for parent.
Or with replace by fee. Depending on the type of transaction.
Right. Yeah. But in this case, we're talking about child pays for parent mostly, right? For the fix we're going to discuss right now.
Yeah, because if you're talking about Lightning, what often happens is that you and your channel partner agree about a transaction, you pre-sign it. And so at the moment you sign it, you don't know what the mempool fees are going to be in the future. And so the only way to, if there's some conflict, or you can't find the other side, the only way to get your transaction then included to get it in the mempool at all is that it must have enough fees to make it in the mempool period. And to bump it, you cannot replace it because you don't have the... You can't RBF a transaction because the other side has to do the same thing. So child pays for parent is then the only way to get it included in the next block or to even get it in the mempool.
Yeah, so in other words, if I want to get my money out of a Lightning payment channel, then I can do that. and then if the transaction fee of me doing that is not high enough, because this was all like pre-done, then what I can do is, okay, you know what, I'll just spend that money that I'm sending to myself anyways, and I'll spend it in a new transaction also to myself, and I'll include a higher fee. And then, you know, nodes will figure out that, okay, if we include both of these transactions in a block, then we get both of these fees. So that usually works, unless if that first transaction where I'm originally getting my money out of this Lightning payment channel, if that transaction doesn't even have enough fee to fit in people's mempools, then I also can't claim it with this child pays for parent trick, because now this child that I'm using, you know, the child payment that I'm using to claim the money, isn't referring to something that other nodes know about, because the parent transaction, the first transaction, already fell out of their mempool. So the idea to fix that is that I should be able to tell other nodes on the network, hey, I want to pay for this transaction as well, so please consider both of these transactions. I know that the first transaction doesn't have enough fee for your mempool, I know that, but look, I got another transaction, please consider them both.
Yeah, and right? The nice
thing—that's what we're trying to accomplish here.
Yeah, and if you can do that, then one benefit is that when you open a Lightning channel, you can use a very low fee by default, because you know you can just add whatever fees are needed later, and you don't have to think about the absolute worst case inscription hype type mempool situation. Just assume an easy mempool.
Yeah,
so it'd be nice if this was possible, but currently it isn't.
Yeah, I'll repeat this one more time to make it very simple, hopefully, in case there's still someone out there who doesn't understand. So when it comes to including transactions into blocks, transactions are potentially considered in combinations. Like if one transaction spends from another, then the fees are sort of added up, and a miner will figure, okay, if I include them all, then I get enough fees.
Yeah, and the miner has an incentive to do that, of course.
Yeah, yeah. So the goal is to accomplish a similar logic for the mempool. So nodes will also see, okay, we're going to consider these transactions as a combination of transactions rather than each individually. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's what we're trying to achieve here. That's what Bitcoin Core developers are trying to achieve.
Yeah, some Bitcoin Core developers, not me per se, but I try to understand what they're doing.
Right, and now in Bitcoin Core 28, there's been some actual good progress on this this goal.
Yeah, we've got four buzzwords, basically, and we'll try to explain them.
So the first one you wrote down is one parent, one child packages.
Yes, and so...
Well, yeah, go on.
Yeah, so the most simple example, which is the example you gave, is you have one parent, this, for example, this Lightning close thing, and one child, which is your fee bump.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a special case of a package, the simplest possible package. And that, so basically support has been added to Bitcoin Core to handle that very specific case. Using, under the hood, something called the orphanage. As far as I understand it.
Because, so there's actually a part of the Bitcoin Core code that is called the orphanage.
Yes. And remember when Roger Ver said that Bitcoin Core kills babies? Well, it turns out Bitcoin Core kills a lot of them because the orphanage doesn't really work.
It was actually true. Okay. So what is the orphanage and how does it work?
Well,
how does it not work?
Okay. I'm a little vague on this, so if you really, truly, deeply want to understand this, you should look at everything Gloria Zhao has been writing on various mailing lists and other places.
Mm-hmm. Which explains
in more detail. But roughly, the idea is this: you and I are exchanging transactions. You want to close your channel. You want to send me those transactions, right? Mm-hmm. And so the first thing you do is you tell me, "Hey, I have some new transactions." Namely, and then you don't give me the full transaction, you just give me some identifier of them. So you give me a list, and I look at that list, and I say, well, okay, send them to me. So then you're sending me the full transactions. But, and so this would be the Lightning close transaction that you want to send me, and the child that you want to send me.
Mm-hmm.
However, before we did any of that, I told you, like, I'm not interested in transactions that are paying a very low fee.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Lightning X transaction, let's say, is below that level, but your child is above it.
So you're, for example, saying, I only want transactions that at least pay 3 sats per byte.
Yeah. And so you being very nice, you don't send me the thing that you actually want to include. You just sent me the child. And that child then goes into the orphanage, into my orphanage, because I recognize that this transaction looks interesting, seems to pay a lot of fees, but I don't know the parent. So then a while later, probably a fraction of a second later, I ask you, could you please give me this parent?
Mm-hmm.
And you say, sure. Mm-hmm. You didn't send it before because the fee rate, but now because I'm asking you, if I'm asking you, you're going to send it to me regardless.
Yeah.
And so I look at it and say, well, this doesn't pay enough fees, and I just throw it away.
Sure.
And then later on, the child is also thrown out of the orphanage. That's how it used to work.
That's rough.
That's, yeah, you know, life on the blockchain is rough, and life in the mempool is even rougher.
Oh my God. So you request the parent of that poor child, and I send you the parent, and you still throw them both away.
Yes.
Do you at least throw them away together?
No, I'd probably be separately. So that is, as far as I understand, the thing that is being fixed. And you could say it's a bit of a hack. It doesn't really scale towards more complicated groups of transactions, but this one child, one parent use case is very useful already for the example we just discussed. So I believe the main thing that this release changes is that when you're sending this parent, this time it will look at it and say, oh, look at that. If I combine this parent with this child that I have here in the orphanage, it does pay enough. Let me accept that and let me forward it to peers the same way, who then repeat the same process if they're all upgraded. So as long as there is a bunch of upgraded nodes between you and the miner, they will finally get both of them.
This is a very wholesome upgrade then.
Yes.
I'm very happy with
but
this
But it is also a bit of a duct tape solution.
Why?
Well, the orphanage is not really designed to handle like the generic case of thousands of packages, etc. And you can quite easily overwhelm it. So if you send... So let's say instead of...
It's a small orphanage.
It's a very small orphanage. So if you're sending 1,000 children, then the orphanage is going to throw away like all but the last 5, right? So if...
It's a hard knock life.
It's a hard life on the mempool, even harder than on the blockchain.
So basically what you're saying is...
What I'm saying is...
The adversarial, person in the Bitcoin network can intentionally create all kinds of transactions that don't even have a parent or a child.
Well, they might have it, but you just... Yeah, it's never gonna, you're never going to ask for it because there's too many orphans at the same time. Stuff like that. So as far as I understand it, there needs to be a better mechanism to really deal with this problem of one parent, one child, and multiple parents, multiple children. But this, hopefully is good enough that under most circumstances, you will get your Lightning Close transaction to a miner.
But there might be a better solution. Tomorrow.
I don't know.
I'm making any references, yours.
Okay.
Orphanage. Never mind. We're moving on to the next point. There are fee-free transactions.
Yeah. And so...
Version-free transactions.
Yeah. And so that's just a field in the transaction that says number 3, where it currently usually says number 2. So you may wonder...
So the transactions are the same. Now they just are version-free. Okay. What does it mean?
Yeah. And that doesn't apply to all transactions. It applies to special transactions that care about the following. Truck. And so... Truck stands for, was it again, topologically constrained until confirmation. Topologically constrained until confirmation. So in other words, there are topologies, so how transactions relate to each other. There are rules for that in the mempool, not in the blockchain. So it's until confirmation. And you may wonder, what rules? Well, roughly, it needs to be a one-child, one-parent pair. Exactly that special case that we just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other rule, I believe, is that the child cannot be more than 10 kilobytes or 10 kilovbytes. And this just means that if you opt into this version number, there are a lot of shenanigans that somebody trying to keep you out of the mempool or keep you from bumping the fees, etc., because we didn't really talk about that scenario, can be prevented. So it's not really interesting to the scenario you started with, which is you're not in the mempool, you want to be in the mempool. But it's the more complicated thing called pinning attacks that we would need a Lightning expert to completely explain. But it comes down to, like, you are in the mempool, but you want to be higher in the mempool. Because if you stay at the bottom of the mempool, then you'll just never get confirmed. And that's not good because there might be a deadline for your Lightning transaction that you want to close it.
Hang on. So, okay, I'm sending a transaction, right? So then I decide if that's going to be a fee 2 or fee 3 or fee 1 transaction.
Yeah, exactly.
It can be whatever I want.
Mm-hmm.
And that, but if I make it a fee 3 transaction, then it cannot have any grandchildren, you know, it cannot have any children of children in the mempool.
Exactly.
It can only have grandkids when it is included in the blockchain.
That's right.
And there is a benefit to this, which has something to do with pinning attacks and Lightning, I don't understand.
Yeah,
and you also so this, can't quite explain.
No, exactly. But generally in Lightning, you are coordinating a transaction together with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so that transaction, you may want to have it in the mempool because the situation is to your benefit to get it included, or they might want it in the mempool because it's in their benefit to get it in the mempool.
Mm-hmm.
And you may have a conflict there where the other side may want to stop you from getting it into the mempool. And you can do all sorts of shenanigans where you attach lots and lots of small transactions or very large transactions with too low fees to this Lightning close transaction so that it doesn't get into the mempool or doesn't get high enough into the mempool and you can't bump it anymore because the RBF rules are complicated. And so all that goes away with V3 because there can only be one child. And, you know, you may still have to race for paying higher fees, but it's somewhat limited.
It's a Bitcoin Core's one child policy.
Yes. I'm sure that will make people have
very happy. The connotations here are less than optimal, sure, but I will remind the listener, it's an opt-in thing. You don't have to, you can have as many child as you want.
Yeah, exactly. You don't have to use those V3 transactions.
Okay. So that's a new thing. I don't quite understand the benefit. Well, I kind of, let's just move
it,
to the
it
next
removes
thing.
All the stuff that we don't understand.
Right. Got it.
So we don't have to explain how pinning works because it's less of a problem.
Got it. And then there's one more thing to the whole mempool upgrade.
Yes. The last buzzword.
Yes. And then we're done with the mempool upgrades. So we had the one parent, one child packages kind of with the orphanages. And then we were just discussing the version 3, one child only policy. And now, and that's called the TRUC. What
TRUC.
Stands for?
Topologically restrained. Sorry. Yeah, I think topologically restricted. Until confirmation.
Okay. Yes, you can only have grandchilds while you're in the when you're in the blockchain as a transaction. Being a transaction, anyways. Okay. And then there's something called P2A.
Yes.
What is P2A?
Pay to anchor. And so we talked about this situation where you want to make a child to pay for the parent. Now the question is, what does that child look like? It can be anything. Doesn't really matter as long as it pays a lot of fees. But you want it to be small because you don't have to pay just the fees for your parent. You also have to pay your own fees.
Mm-hmm.
So you want the child to be as small as possible. And pay to anchor is like a new standardness rule that lets you make a very, very small transaction to do just that.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny thing about it is that on the blockchain, the address will look like something like one fees or BC1P mm-hmm. fees. And that's done with a special, very small script that just happens to represent the word fees. But it's really just a way to make it easier to make these children. It mm-hmm. doesn't have any special meaning otherwise. But the change is that these are now standard, so they will actually get relayed.
Okay, so it was already possible, according to the consensus rules, to create this.
Yeah.
But so far, Bitcoin Core wouldn't relay them.
Yeah, and now if I understand correctly, it wouldn't relay spending them. So you could send money to that address, but you couldn't spend from it.
Okay, and this is specifically intended to also benefit these other things we just discussed with the orphanage and the one child policy, etc.
Yeah, because that's the child is now spending from that address essentially, and okay. You can do that, or anybody else can do it too. So maybe you want to outsource it to a Watchtower or something like that.
Long story short, now with Bitcoin Core 28, mempool policy has improved to the point where it makes Lightning a bit more usable, reliable.
When they start using it, and that might be another year.
Of
Who
course,
knows?
Right. At least Bitcoin Core has now facilitated Lightning to become more usable, cheaper.
Yeah, hopefully.
That sort of stuff. Okay.
And I mean, when we say Lightning, we mean anything that has the same concerns as Lightning.
Right, yeah. But yeah, a lot of layer two protocols actually have these kinds of issues, of course. Okay, well, we're just discussing relay policy with the anchor stuff. Speaking of relay policy, Bitcoin Core, so next topic. We're done with the mempool stuff. Next topic.
More mempool stuff.
Here's more mempool stuff for you. Full RBF is now the default.
Yeah, so we've done multiple episodes about full RBF. If you look for the term in our show notes or in our history, you will find it.
Replaced by fee?
Yes. Well, full RBF, you know, says like it's fully replacing, but anyway, it doesn't really matter. It the only thing it does is it turns the flag off. So, or it ignores the flag. So it used to be that you had something called opt-in RBF, where you would signal that your transaction could be replaced. And if you didn't signal that, then nodes, if they were nice, would not replace it. If they were not nice, they would replace it. So unconfirmed transactions were always safe, unsafe for that reason, because it's just a mempool rule. So, but then this new setting came in that lets your node basically ignore this flag and say, I'm going to just anything that pays a higher fee and meets all these other conditions will get relayed now. You don't need the flag anymore.
That was a setting in Bitcoin Core.
Yeah, that was off by default, because it was a new thing. But now it turns out that most miners appear to be also using that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when miners are using a certain mempool policy, it is better for full nodes to also use that policy so that their mempool reflects the next block accurately.
Mm-hmm.
And this helps with things like compact block relay, where you relay not the whole block to your peers when you see it, but you relay a very short summary. And that short summary relies on the fact that the person you're sending it to has the same mempool as you do. And so we'll recognize. You don't need to send all the transactions to your peers. You just send the header and a few other details. That doesn't work. And that started to, you could measure that it was working less well. So basically block relay was getting slower because too many people were using full RBF, but too many people were not. And now hopefully it'll speed up again because everybody will be using full RBF, or most people.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this has obviously been a pretty controversial topic over the, for over 10 years now.
Yeah.
RBF in itself, some people would argue that it makes unconfirmed transactions less reliable, whereas previously they were still pretty reliable. You know, if you got a transaction, even if it was unconfirmed, you would probably just receive it. And now that's been... You know, that's a lot less obvious now that it won't get replaced by a completely different transaction.
I'm not sure if it matters that much in practice. You'd have to ask merchants who still use it. There's not that many of them. They probably use all sorts of other risk scoring techniques that are completely unrelated to the use of this flag, but this flag would make it more difficult to perform the attack. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyways, we've discussed RBF at length in different episodes, so let's just... keep it at that. Any case, Bitcoin Core 28 now has full RBF on by default.
Yeah, and then for later on, we need to figure out, do we want to get rid of this flag? Do we like deprecate BIP 125 or like that part of it? Or
that's the flag privacy. Seems pretty useless now, right?
It's useless, yes, but if Bitcoin Core turns it off, but everybody else doesn't, now you know which wallets are using Bitcoin Core. So there's still the question of what to do with the flag. And maybe we should just say, like, it should just be there. That just doesn't mean anything anymore.
Right.
I don't know.
I say remove it. Get rid of it. Just a full RBF is the new reality. Okay. Assume UTXO is available on mainnet.
Yes. We talked about Assume UTXO in episode number... 14 in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ready. Well, you still need some command line magic, but you can basically, how you use it is you download a torrent.
What is it? What are we talking about?
That's what I'm explaining.
Okay, remind our listener. I'm explaining it? Okay, so, good.
So you download a torrent, about 10 gigabytes, which represents the UTXO set during the halving block. So it represents who owned what coin at block 840,000.
Mm-hmm.
Then your node loads that snapshot and it checks it based on the hash that the developers put in. It doesn't trust it. It just assumes it. Hence, it's called assume UTXO.
Mm-hmm.
Then it goes to the tip, which is quick because it's only 6 months worth of blocks.
From now, yeah.
Yeah, and from that point on, you can use your node pretty much normally. You can create a wallet, you can receive coins, you can send coins, you have a mempool, all that stuff works. Meanwhile, in the background, it starts at the Genesis block, goes all the way to block 840,000, make sure that the ETXO set from Genesis actually matches what you assumed. And it's the moment it confirms that, it's happy. And if not, it crashes.
Right. So for a limited amount of time, you are kind of trusting the developers.
Yes.
You know, potentially the developers could have, attributed coins to themselves that weren't really theirs, to name an extreme example.
Yeah.
But your node is still, you know, it's a temporary thing. It's like, okay, it's a stopgap until the node is really fully synced.
And the other thing is,
you're just going to
any kind of fraud would be trivial to detect, right? Because anybody can take their own node, make this snapshot themselves, compare the hash, and look at the code and say, hey, the hash in the code does not actually match what I found. So it's not just new people using it that would be surprised by this. Everybody would be saying, hey, why is Bitcoin Core putting a invalid snapshot in the source code? But it does actually check against this or something. So you cannot get a snapshot from a random...
Why is all my money gone? And why is Shor's so rich all of a sudden?
Something like that, yeah. So it's not the case that you can just download a snapshot from a random person on the internet and they could pull that thing on you, because Bitcoin Core is expecting a specific one. But maybe in the future that might change. It depends on what people want and what risks you're worried about.
Right.
But you still have to do, like, you have to find the torrent, you have to download it, you have to enter a command. So the next steps will be to make that process easier.
Right. Okay, so that's included in Bitcoin Core 28 as well.
Yep.
Next point, it's now easier to migrate your wallet from your legacy wallet to the new descriptor wallet format.
Yeah, so basically... A couple of years ago already, the Bitcoin Core wallet was changed in two important ways. One is it uses a more modern way to organize keys using descriptors. We probably talked about that a little bit along with Miniscript.
We've definitely spoken about this in one of our episodes.
Basically, the wallet used to be just a bag of keys and some scripts and some logic to make sure that it's presenting sane addresses, and this has been made much more elegant in a way that's also easier to import your wallet, export your wallet, that sort of stuff. The other thing that changed is the database backend, which is a bit boring, but we used to have wallets, the wallet used to use Berkeley DB, which is a very, very old piece of software that we use a 10-year-old version of from like 2014 or even older, I think, maybe 2010. And the new modern wallets use SQLite 3, which is a modern database thing. And so those two things were combined. So it's the nicer organized scripts and the more modern database backend. And now the goal is to get rid of that old database backend. But of course, you know, there's a lot of money in these old wallets, so we don't want people to lose anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a migration tool that has already been there for a while, but you need the command line. And I believe now you can do it from the GUI. And this tool is going to get more and more like insistent that you use it, because the goal is to get rid of the old database format. But there is a way that we can still read those old wallets. So we will get rid of the software dependency, but there will still be code in Bitcoin Core that can read the old wallet and then upgrade it, but you cannot use it anymore.
So let's say I have a Bitcoin Core wallet that's still a legacy wallet. What's the incentive for me to upgrade? What's the benefit for me, if any?
Sanity, but in the future you don't have a choice.
Okay.
It will basically say like, hey, you need to upgrade this wallet, otherwise you can't use it. We'll keep, you know, you keep a backup of the old thing. So if there is a problem, please file a bug report.
Right.
But yeah.
Okay. So that's now a bit upgrading or migrating, I should say, is now a bit easier.
Yeah.
You can actually see what you're doing if you're not a developer.
I think it just press a button. Yeah.
Yeah. I like buttons. Final point. Last point of this episode. Sure.
Yeah. There's plenty more in the release, but this is what we're going to cover.
Yeah. We're.
This is the most exciting feature, I think, of the release.
Is that sarcasm?
Yes.
Block files are... I'm not sure how to pronounce this. XOR?
Yeah.
Yeah. Block file XOR. What is a block file XOR?
Well, the goal is, the problem here
what's
is
new
that,
here
is that there are virus scanners out there, and they historically already they would look at your mempool and they would look at your blocks, And then if something was, especially back then in the mempool, that looked like a virus, like a transaction that just has, you know, an op return, which doesn't do anything, but the op return is followed by a well-known worm or a well-known virus, then the virus scanner doesn't know that it's just a, you know, an op return and doesn't do anything. It just sees the pattern of the virus. It puts your whole Bitcoin Core node into quarantine. Or worse, it puts some files in quarantine, but breaking the node, basically.
We did discuss this at some point in some context, but I think...
Yeah, I think so too. And from what I remember is it was first added to the mempool, the solution that we're about to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
And that same solution is now also applied to the blockchain files on your disk.
Right. Okay. So the problem indeed is, so you're storing all kinds of data in your mempool, in your blockchain, and this data can also be generated, is usually generated by other people on the internet.
Yeah.
And it can be generated in such a way, like you said, people can just put data in an op return, for example, that just looks a lot like a virus. And then your virus scanner will, you know, say, hey, that doesn't look good to me. I'm just going to lock this entire program over here,
yep.
Which in that case is Bitcoin. So you can't use Bitcoin anymore.
Yep.
So there was a solution for this for the mempool already. I'm pretty sure we discussed that. And now the same solution has been applied to the blockchain itself. So what's the solution?
Yeah, the solution is called XOR, which basically, how to easily, it scrambles it. Obviously, but it scrambles it in a symmetrical way. So you use one key
from the blockchain in this case.
Yeah, on disk. It uses a key, a very simple key, and it just encrypts everything with that key. And with the same key, it can decrypt it. And this operation is extremely fast on most computers, so it can be done easily. It's not meant to be a secure form of encryption. Like any 5-year-old can decrypt it because the encryption key is literally stored next to it. So it's like, here's the encryption key. Like, please go decrypt it. It's right. Just enough to trick the virus scanner.
Right. Just to hide it from the virus scanner.
Yeah. And right. So if the virus scanner tries to be really smart and says, well, I think that's a decryption key, let me decrypt it, then it's game over. But
right.
Hopefully, because viruses, of course, use this trick too, to hide some of their own code. So they might start with some code that is just enough to extract the real code. And so virus scanners will look at code that, you know, decrypts bad code, etc. So hopefully this won't be a cat and mouse game, but there it is.
Okay. Okay. Well, that covers it. Well, as we mentioned, there's of course a whole bunch of new, upgrades, maintenance, all kinds of stuff happening with Bitcoin Core. But these were some of the most notable changes in Bitcoin Core 28.
That's right.
Where can people find Bitcoin Core 28, Shores?
BitcoinCore.org.
Great.
Or they can go on Noster and follow me or Vladimir von der Laan, who, the former lead maintainer. And there you can actually get a torrent directly that doesn't even take you to GitHub. But you should probably just go to bitcoincore.org.
Sounds good.
Yep. All right, then. Thank you for listening to Bitcoin
Explained.